You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
J. Randy Tarabarelli returns to the show this week. He is the author of about 300 books, in-depth biographies of the famous and powerful. Most often, Randy Tarabarelli writes about strong women, such as Beyoncé, Cher, Madonna, Elizabeth Taylor, Marilyn Monroe, Grace Kelly, and Diana Ross. He's also chronicled the Kennedy clan and Camelot in several volumes, including his 2019 book, The Kennedy Heirs, John, Carolyn, and the New Generation, A Legacy of Triumph and Tragedy. All these books have been bestsellers, due in no small part to his appearance with me on this show every time. He's got a new book, and it is, again, a chronicle of powerful women. It's called Grace and Steel, Dorothy, Barbara, Laura, and the Women of the Bush Dynasty. J. Randy Tarabarelli, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it. It's good to see you again.
You too. And this book, you've been working on this book just for about 20 years. Is that right?
Yes. Actually, the idea of this book came to me almost 22 years ago when I interviewed Barbara Bush for a women's magazine. And I wanted at that time to work with her on a book, which would have been the follow-up to my book, Jackie, Ethel, and Joan, Women of Camelot, had it happened. But she was working on her autobiography at that time. And she said that, you know, she was pretty much almost finished and she just, you know, she took a pass. And so I went on with my career. And then a couple of years ago, I published Jackie, Janet, and Lee, which was a story of Jackie Kennedy and her mom, Janet Auchincloss, and her sister, Lee Radziwill. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to do the same kind of book with the Bush women? And that's how this sort of evolved.
Well, I want to ask you, I asked you once why you love to write about powerful women, and you said in part because women buy more books than men. And I'm sure there's more to it than that. But when I got your new book, I was thinking, so I did a little research because I was interested, who buys more books or who reads more books, Republicans or Democrats? Because in the past, you've written mostly about the Kennedys in terms of politics, and here you are now tackling a Republican dynasty. And I discovered that nobody reads books at all. But among the people who read books, more Democrats tend to read books than Republicans. Did you consider that at all when you were?
I didn't even know that until this very moment. no, I never think about politics when I choose subjects or when I write about subjects or even when I am in the process of writing about a subject. Politics is. I am not a political writer. You know, I don't consider myself a political writer at all. I consider myself a writer of the human condition. And so, you know, whether my subject is a Democrat or a Republican doesn't make any difference to me at all. As long as the family dynamic is there, and as long as the drama is there and the humanity is there, it doesn't make any difference to me what their politics is. So, you know, the political aspects of my book, of all of my books, are very much like homework for me, you know, because I really have to study and, you know, and try to put myself in that political mode and try to be as accurate as I can about the political backdrop of every story that I'm writing, because in essence, that's not really the thrust of the book. The thrust of the book are the personal dynamics that are going on while the politics is happening in the background. And so anyway, to answer your question, no, I mean, I have found that this book is a little bit of a tougher sell than I had anticipated because, you know, the country is so divided right now that you really have to appeal to, you know, two factions, Republicans and Democrats, with a book like this. And I didn't anticipate that at all. I've never had to do that before. I've never even thought about that before. And And with this book, we've really had to sort of like break through in a way that's very different than anything I've ever experienced.
Well, when you were doing your research into the Bush women, obviously, of course, you researched the Bush men as well, because you can't separate the stories. And, you know, at the time of, say, President Kennedy's election, it was a very different America where, although, you know, he had a huge opposition, I mean, he only won his presidential election by a very thin margin, yet America got behind him and said, okay, well, he's our president now. And he had a very successful 100 days, first 100 days, and probably would have been reelected and was doing well with the support of a large portion of the population. Whereas today, and this really kind of was definitely true with George Herbert Walker Bush, but was really true with George W. Bush, the opposition party is just immediately in opposition and won't, and we're certainly seeing that now, they don't want to give an inch. There's just this, like you're just saying, this divide in our country, which is, you know, it's severe, and it's, I think it's disabling to the country achieving any real progress. But how did the people involved feel about it as this rift began to develop in the 2000s?
Well, I think that the difference between what was happening with the Bushes and even Obama is that in those cases, the president didn't encourage it. And Donald Trump encouraged it. And I think that that's the biggest difference, that Donald Trump encouraged this opposition in a way that former presidents did not. The opposition existed, and they fought the opposition as much as they could, but they didn't encourage it. And I think that that's why we're in this kind of mess we're in right now, is because, you know, whether you're a fan of Donald Trump or not, I think that you would have to agree that he encouraged this kind of opposition for 4 years, bringing us to a point now where half the country doesn't accept that Biden is even president. You know, in the past, you might have had half the country not approve, or you might have had half the country be upset, or you might have had half the country not like the guy, but you would never have half the country just flat out reject the idea that he was even president. And that's where that's where we are today. And I think that, you know, I don't know how this is going to get resolved. You know, I think that Biden probably is doing the best he can to not encourage it and to try to break that cycle. But I'm not sure that he's going to be able to.
It's a tough situation. So when I'm reading, when I'm reading the Grace and Steele, it was almost nostalgic to a simpler time when, you know, we had a working government. And regardless of political party, you have to admire these the people involved, and you bring them all to life in such a great way in this book. And it's a saga of not just three women, but a lot of people and a lot of other women, including the next generation, Laura Bush's daughters. And I really enjoyed it. But I want you to start off by telling us a little bit about George Bush Sr.'s mother. She's really a interesting character in the story.
Well, Dorothy Walker Bush is really sort of the reason that I wanted to write this book. I had a difficult time sort of pinning this subject down. And over the course of the last 22 years, I started it a number of times. And then about maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I was working on this book, and I couldn't. It was too political for me, and it wasn't family oriented enough. And as I said, I'm not a political writer, and I don't really want to be. And so I told my publisher, you know what, I think I'm going to abandon this book and let's find something else to do. They were surprised because I'd never done that before in my entire career. And they said, well, if you really feel that strongly about it, then we will. And so that's when I turned to Beyonce, which was like as far away from the bushes as you can imagine. And I wrote the Beyonce book, and I was, you know, very happy with that subject. But when I discovered Dorothy Walker Bush a couple of years ago, I found out that she wrote a column for a newspaper syndicate called My Life as a Senator's Wife. And she wrote this column for 10 years, 3 days a week. And the Bush Library gave me access to all of the columns. And there are more than 1,000 of them. And she was so detailed and specific about her life and her relationship with Barbara Bush and with her husband, Prescott, and with her entire family. Much more candid, I think, than anybody would ever be today. Mm. And it was really sort of like Dorothy Bush was talking to me, you know, through more than 1,000 columns. And it gave me what I needed for this book. It gave me the foundation, the family foundation. When you've got the matriarch speaking to you from the great beyond, you really have a golden opportunity to do something. And she was an amazing woman, to answer your question. She was a feminist long before feminism was even a thing. You know, I was so impressed with the fact that she felt that what she wrote in her column is that she said to Barbara Bush, you know, you don't have to do everything that my son tells you to do. And this was in the 1950s, you know, when traditional housewives pretty much did what their husbands told them to do. And Dorothy was anything but traditional. She insisted on equality in her marriage to Prescott, the senator. And she felt that her daughter-in-law, Barbara, should insist on the same equality in her marriage to George H.W. And even though George H.W. was Dorothy's son, and you would have thought that Dorothy would have sided with him, she never did. She always sided with her daughter-in-law, and she always wanted her daughter-in-law to have more agency in her marriage. And this is in the 1950s, you know. And what's also interesting is taking it a step farther, Barbara Bush didn't even agree with her. Barbara Bush felt that H.W. was the boss and that her place was to listen to what he had to say. And Dorothy would have been fine with that if she knew that Barbara was happy. But Barbara was so profoundly unhappy that Dorothy felt, you know, that she needed to change her life. She needed to make different decisions. Eventually, Barbara did, you know, but it took her almost 30 years, you know. So I just think that she's an incredible character. And I was able to do with this book something that I had the opportunity to do with Jackie, Janet, and Lee, which was introduce a brand new character to my readers. When I wrote Jackie, Janet, and Lee, people did not know anything about Janet Auchincloss. And it was my great honor to be able to introduce them to this amazing woman, Jackie Kennedy Onassis's mother. And to be able to do the same thing now with Dorothy Walker Bush was such a treat for me.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf Fund, KSEO. And we are talking this week with the New York Times best-selling biographer, J. Randy Tarabarelli. His new book is called Grace and Steel, Dorothy, Barbara, Laura, and the Women of the Bush Dynasty. Right before the break, we were talking about your previous book, Jackie, Janet, and Lee, The Secret Lives of Janet Auchincloss and Her Daughters, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis and Lee Radziwill. And in that book, you bring us the assassination of President Kennedy from an angle that we had never seen before.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that you say that because I just finished writing the pilot to the Jackie Janet Lee series that we're doing.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, which is called Money and Power. And the first episode is exactly that. The first episode is the JFK assassination through the vantage point of Janet. And I just think that, you know, we've seen the assassination so many times, but we had never seen it that way, through the eyes of Janet and also through the eyes of Jamie, her son, who was, you know, a great source of information for me with that book, because he's her only son and he was there for every moment of all of it, you know. But yeah, I loved it. I just really loved writing that book.
And I love this book too. And again, it's called Grace and Steel. Dorothy, Barbara, Laura, and the women of the Bush dynasty. We're talking with J. Randy Tarabarelli. You know, and I know, Randy, that you really get into the people that you're writing about and you follow them. You don't just say, okay, well, I'm done writing about Michael Jackson now and I don't have to think about him again. But you continue to be interested and you stick with your subjects. Any thoughts about Beyonce? The other night, they made a big deal about how she has won more Grammy Awards than any other woman in Grammy history.
You know, my thoughts about, I feel very territorial about my subjects. No one has written a book about Beyonce other than me, you know? And if somebody else writes a book about her, I'm going to be really pissed off. Because I just really feel like she's mine, you know? And I interviewed her for the first time way back during the Destiny's Child years. And I saw back then the hard work and the work ethic and just the incredible drive and focus that she has had. And I think that she said this in her speech, that she's been doing this since she was 9 years old. And, you know, she so deserved every accolade, because she's such a good-hearted person. And I have to say that I've been in show business or writing about show business for all of my life, since I was 10 years old. And good-hearted people in show business are often hard to find, you know, because it changes you. And as you've read in my books, you know, it sort of skews everything. Show business has a way of poisoning everything, as does politics. And to be able to rise above that and still be a good person despite that is not easy. And Beyonce has done that. You know, you don't hear terrible things about Beyonce. And even in my book, you're not going to read any terrible things about Beyonce. And when the book came out, people were like, oh, wow, you didn't say anything terrible about it. Well, you know, I can only give you what is there. And she's not a terrible person. Sorry, you know. So I loved writing that book. And I love her. I think she's great. And I'm glad you asked about her. I haven't had a chance to say a word about her in a long time.
So one of the things I think was so interesting about your new book, Grace and Steel, was that Barbara Bush was bullied to a certain extent as a kid, but was also a bully.
Yeah, when she was young, you know, Barbara's relationship with her mother, Pauline, who I wrote a lot about Pauline in this book because I was totally fascinated by Pauline. And her mom, Pauline, was a very critical person. Who felt that it was her responsibility in life to make other people better, you know? And as I wrote in the book, she used to have two favorite sayings: "That's remarkable," or "That's unremarkable." Right? And where Barbara was concerned, when I interviewed Barbara Bush, she told me something that she had said many times before, and the fact that she would often say this and it was like part of her sort of vocabulary. She would often say that my mother had many interests and unfortunately I was not one of them. And I thought that was such a sad commentary, you know, about her relationship with her mom. And yeah, her mom was very, very critical and you could say very bullying of Barbara. And in return, when Barbara was a young girl in school, she became a bully in school. And I interviewed women today who still have very vivid memories of being bullied by Barbara Bush, and they're in their 90s, right? I mean, I guess you never get over it, you know?
It's a traumatic experience when you're in elementary school and none of the other girls will talk to you and you don't know why.
Exactly. You're right. I mean, thank you for reading. You obviously read the book, and I appreciate that because a lot of people don't have time to. But you're right. That's in the book. And, you know, Barbara would say, you know, she'd say to a group of girls, today, we're not going to talk to Anne. And they would say, well, why? And she would say, because that's what we're going to do today. We're not going to talk to her. And this poor girl, Anne, would have no idea why all of the girls were not talking. I mean, this is very, very traumatic when you're in the first grade, you know, when all and Barbara would kind of rotate, you know, today we're not going to talk to her. And then that girl would feel the sort of the wrath of a Barbara's clique of friends. I don't know what this was about, but I could speculate that a couple of things. First of all, it sounded to me like she was taking out on others what was being taken out on her by her mother. That's number one. And number two, I felt like she was sort of claiming her power, that she had no power at home. She had no agency in her relationship with her mom or in her family life. And so when she was at school, that's when she claimed her power. And her power was being able to sort of put these chess pieces in order, the way that she wanted them to be. And she was, you know, quite the little bully. So I just think it's a psychologically very interesting, an interesting thing, because you wouldn't think of Barbara Bush that way at all.
But you did reference a few minutes ago that she was an unhappy person in her adult life. What contributed to her unhappiness?
You know, like her mom, Pauline, Barbara suffered from clinical depression for her entire life. And also like her mom, Pauline, it was not discussed. And what I think is interesting is the book that I mentioned earlier that Barbara was writing when she and I first met, her autobiography. When that book finally came out, that was the first time that her children, including George W., ever heard that she suffered from depression, was when she wrote about it in her book. That's the first time they even recognized that that's what it was. And when you think about the fact that, you know, your kids are like in their 40s and they still don't know that you suffered from depression their entire childhood, that's an amazing thing. And I think it just tells you how much of a stigma was and still is, but definitely was attached to depression back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. This depression combined with lack of self-esteem, that was also, you know, something that was a consequence of her mother. The fact that HW was having an affair with another woman for 18 years, mm-hmm. and Barbara tolerated that, combined with the death of her child at the age of 3, Robin, all of these things, you know, made for a very often unhappy woman.
And how did you come to discover her husband's infidelity?
Well, you know, I'd like to say that it's funny because people have said to me, wow, that's such an amazing revelation. It's not, I like to claim it as my own, but it really is not. The fact of the matter is that the affair came to light in 1991 when George Bush was giving a press conference at Kennebunkport with the Prime Minister of Israel. And at that time, he and Clinton were campaigning against each other, and Clinton was dealing with Jennifer Flowers,
right? Mm-hmm.
And the Clintons, in order to take the focus away from their Jennifer, put focus on the Bush's Jennifer, which was Jennifer Fitzgerald. And the morning of this press conference, the Clintons leaked to New York newspaper some information about this woman. And the New York newspaper took that information and combined it with somebody else's book and did a front page story about HW's relationship with Jennifer Fitzgerald. And then that day was this press conference. And as I wrote in the book, the Bushes had a feeling that this was going to be asked of them during this press conference. And so what they did was they gathered the entire family together and had them as sort of a backdrop to the president and the prime minister, thinking that nobody would dare ask a question about Jennifer Fitzgerald if the whole Bush family was in the frame. Well,
did Mary, that strategy work?
No, that strategy did not work at all, thanks to the intrepid reporter Mary Tillotson from CNN. If you're old enough to remember Mary Tillotson, you know that she was somebody, and she still is, but back then she was somebody really to contend with. She stood up and just as bold as she could be, asked the president, is this true that you had, and she called it she actually used the word sexual in her question. Did you have a sexual relationship with this woman? And sort of reminiscent of what Bill Clinton would say later on about somebody else, HW said, I never had sex with that woman. And that is completely not true. And that really put this relationship of 18 years into the public domain.
So for Barbara Bush, it wasn't so much that he had the relationship, but that it now was public and something that she had to be embarrassed about.
Yes. I mean, you know, the interesting thing is that by this time, the affair was over, you know, so that they were already sort of trying to recover from it. And, you know, look, what can I tell you? I mean, I've written about this so many times in my career, these men having affairs, you know, that it's sort of old hat for me, you know, and I often think that, as they say, great men have great flaws. And certainly the Kennedys were known for this, you know, Joseph Kennedy, John Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, yeah. Some say Bobby Kennedy. I'm not 100% sure about Bobby, but definitely the rest of them, you know, it's not unusual for men of power to do this. And it's not unusual for women who are married to them to accept it, rather than trash their entire lives and everything that they built together because of this. You know, certainly Jackie Kennedy's advice to Joan Kennedy was really interesting when I wrote about that in my first Kennedy book, Jackie, Ethel, and Joan, when Jackie said, you know, you have to build a life for yourself despite that. Find a thing to do that is yours and don't worry about that. And I don't know that today that would be considered good advice, but back in 1960, you know, things were different.
Things
were different.
Attitudes have changed, certainly.
Yeah.
Laura Bush, one of the things that used to strike me about Laura Bush in the years that she was first lady was that in some ways she was not necessarily embarrassed by her husband, but she's smarter than her husband. When he said, you know, he would say nuclear and she would say nuclear. am I right? What was?
I was not a fan of W's as president. But I became a fan of his with this book. I think that he's a good man with a good heart. No matter what you think of his presidency and the mistakes that were made, which he cops to fully in his book, Decision Points, talks about the fact that he blew it with weapons of mass destruction. And I think that, you know, he has accepted these mistakes in his life and has you know, worked hard to reconcile them in his heart. But what I love about W is, you know, he and Laura Bush have been married for more than 40 years, and they have such a complete understanding of each other and of what they've built together as a couple and of the trials and tribulations that they went through together. And when he met Laura Bush, she was still suffering from post-traumatic stress over the accident that happened when she was 17 years old, and she ran a stop sign, hit a car, and killed another 17-year-old who was a friend of hers named Mike Douglas. And that changed Laura Bush. As you can imagine, it would change any teenager. And she spent many years sort of being a very insular person. As I wrote in the book, she worked in a library. She didn't have a lot of communication with the outside world. She didn't want to date. She, you know, in order to control her life and seize back some of the control from that night, she used to wear the same color clothing. She'd eat the same food every night. You know, she was just in a rut. And she wrote about this in her own book, that she was in a rut. And she lived in a very black and white world until she met George W. Bush really sort of injected color into this black and white world. And he helped her get past this tragedy in her life. And she helped him, because the family really didn't think that W was the one. They thought Jeb was the one. They thought W was the one who was going to screw things up, you know? And they had no confidence in W. They really did not. I mean, it doesn't overstate it to say that, you know, they really did not have confidence in W as a politician. And they would just have soon he not run, because they thought that he was going to embarrass them in some way and in some way also taint his father's legacy. Laura didn't feel that way. Laura saw in him from the very beginning such great promise, and she knew that he had the heart of a public servant, and he had good ideas, and he cared about people. And yeah, I mean, he was, you know, he could be sort of a bumbling kind of guy. But he has a lot, you know, all the Bushisms. If you Google Bushisms, you'll see the long list of sort of the wrong phrases and the mixed up words and all of that. But, you know, Laura Bush really felt that he had what it takes, and she encouraged him. And she was at his side, you know, as when he became governor of Texas, and then when he became president of the United States.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with J. Randy Tarabarelli. He's the author of many great biographies, including his new one, Grace and Steel, Dorothy, Barbara, Laura, and the Women of the Bush Dynasty. President Bush and Laura Bush have two daughters that you write about in the book. Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, I think that the two daughters are really interesting because they remind me of both their mother and father. You know, I don't think Laura Bush would have ever become a public servant had it not been for W. That just was not in the cards for her. And both of these women, Jenna and Barbara, that we're talking about, you know, they're not really public servants, but they have, again, the heart of public service. And they're not going to be politicians, but they care about people. And they're sort of a perfect combination of their parents. And they also remind me a lot of their grandmother, Jenna. Because Jenna Welch, Laura's mom, was such an incredible woman, a West Texas woman. What I loved most about her is that, you know, she and her daughter, Laura, used to lay out on a blanket and look at the stars, because Jenna was very fascinated with astronomy. And they would look at the stars, and Jenna would tell Laura the names of each of the stars. And Laura was a little girl, and Jenna would say to her, you know, this is a big world, and you don't have to stay here in Texas. Like, you should go out and see the rest of the world. It's so unusual when you think about it, because most mothers, I think in the 1960s, would have wanted their daughters to stay close to home. You know, most mothers would have said, you know, find a nice boy and stay in the neighborhood, you know, not go out and explore, you know, but Jenna was just such an interesting woman. And she would, and she would tell Laura, if you go out and you find that West Texas is the place for you, then come back and live here for the rest of your life. But you need to see the world. And it's funny because Laura's position was, I don't really want to see the world. Laura's position was, I love it here and I would love to stay here. You know, so Laura was more traditional than her mom. And that's what I think is so interesting about these women in this book, is that they're never what you think they're going to be. You know, just like Barbara and Dorothy don't have the relationship that you think a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law would have, Laura and Jenna didn't have the relationship that you would have thought the mother and daughter in West Texas would have. You would have thought it would have been the daughter who would say, I need to get out of here. I can't stay here for the rest of my life. And the mother saying, no, please, you know, don't leave. It was the other way around. And that's what I love about the women in this book, is that, you know, they're so paradoxical and so they defy expectation.
I was very interested to read about Columba Bush, Jeb Bush's wife. That was an interesting story too. I mean, you really delve into the entire clan in this book. Tell us a little bit about her and Jeb.
Well, I love that story too. You know, I mean, I don't know. I love these people in a way that probably a biographer is not supposed to love their subjects, because Columba was, you know, they met when she was, when they were like 16 years old. Jeb was in Mexico for, you know, a school sort of an excursion, and he met her, and she didn't speak English, but she had something. She believed in him in the same way that Laura would later believe in W. Even though the family felt that Jeb had what it took to be a politician, he was a terrible student. And they were frustrated with his scholastic blunders and his bad grades. And it wasn't until Columba came into his life that he really began to apply himself to college. And it wasn't until she came into his life that he began to see for himself who he really was. And she brought that out of him. And he wanted to marry her. And Barbara and HW were not thrilled about this, because there had never been a wedding in the family. And they didn't want the first wedding to be to someone they didn't even know, because they hadn't even met her when he proposed. And in fact, HW didn't meet Columba until the night of the rehearsal dinner, which was the night before the wedding. And, you know, but they really didn't have any choice. I mean, one of the things about the Bush men in particular is, you know, they were very, very independent, and they very determined to strike their own course. Even if the family was wanting to hold them back. And that's what Jeb did. I think what's interesting about Jeb and Columba is that their marriage very much mirrors the marriage that HW had with Barbara. Whereas W and Laura is very much like the marriage that Prescott had with Dorothy. So by that, I mean that in the same way that HW sort of ruled the roost with Barbara, that's how Jeb is with Columba. And as you read in my book, there were quite a number of instances along the way where Columba tried to sort of, you know, pull her own power. And she did a couple of interesting things, you know, to kind of show him that, you know, that who was boss, you know. I won't get into them, because you really should read the book. But
it's great.
But I just think that they're such an interesting couple, and they're still married, and they got married before W and Laura, You know, so they've been married for, I don't know, maybe 45 years now.
Well, I was struck by George H.W.'s, he was so romantic with Barbara in the early part of their relationship. I mean, he really wooed her. She was resistant. Yeah.
Yes. Well, you know, they were like 16 years old, you know, maybe 17. I mean, they were young. And he was, you know, he was incredibly romantic. I mean, I wish that he had continued to be that way. I mean, what happened with HW, I think, is when he got into the oil business and then he was really determined to make his own mark and distinguish himself from his father, as could be expected. And he, over the course of time, lost that sort of romantic zeal that he had when he first started out with Barbara. It's funny because then after they left the White House, then he got it back. You know, it's almost like she spent a long time sort of not feeling recognized in their marriage until they were finally out of the White House. Then they had more than 20 years together, where he put her first. But prior to that, you know, it was really, I think, difficult for him to find a way to be a politician and be a husband and be a father. And he left a lot of the raising of the children to Barbara. And she told me that she spent a lot of years being unhappy. You know, it bothered Dorothy that Barbara was so unhappy, because Dorothy felt that if you're unhappy in your marriage, you need to do something about it. I think that what Dorothy did not understand, and really I understand why she wouldn't have understood it, was Barbara's depression interfered with all avenues of change. You know, where Dorothy was very pragmatic. You don't like something, change it. It's not that easy when you're suffering from chronic depression. You know, Barbara wrote in her autobiography that there were times when she would be driving in traffic, and I wrote about this in my book, and she would have an urge to turn the wheel so that she would hit an oncoming car. Like, she had suicide tendencies that were so strong that she wanted to just do herself in by hitting an oncoming car. And she'd have to pull over to the side of the road, and, you know, shaking, she would just have to pull herself together and get past that moment. When you are suffering like that, it's not easy for you to just pull yourself together. You know, like, you don't have a stiff upper lip like Dorothy would have wanted. You know, you don't have that ability to just, you know, just plow through the way Dorothy Walker Bush would have wanted her to.
It's such a rich book, Randy. There's so much in it. It's called Grace and Steel, Dorothy, Barbara, Laura, and the Women of the Bush Dynasty. It's like five books in one. So now you've written 405 books. And the author, the brilliant J. Randy Tarabarelli, thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to see you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.